Right before the pandemic changed all of our travel plans a few years ago, we invited three of our favorite English tour guides into our Travel with Rick Steves studio to take listener calls about travel plans for Britain. Going through our inventory, we found there were still a couple of callers whose questions about touring gardens and stone circles had never made it on the air. Until now. We're going to take a few minutes now and help you plan your English adventure. We're joined by three experts, three English tour guides right here in our studio. Tom Hoopers from the southwest of England, Gillian Chadwicks, a Blue Badge guide from London, and Roy Nichols is a tour guide who's lived in Shropshire and currently calls Dorset his home. Tom, Gillian, and Roy, thanks for joining us.
You're very well. Welcome. Lovely to be here.
Lynn's on the line from Carson City in Nevada. Lynn, thanks for your call.
Thank you. We're going to be making a trip to England and Scotland next fall. And I love to go visit gardens, but the fall is not always the best time of the year to go see them. And I was wondering which ones would be the best to see in late September, early October.
First of all, we'll talk to Roy Nichols, because I know Roy has a big love of gardens. There's a lot of great gardens in England. Is the season really critical?
It can be. Many of them are based around the very traditional English garden type of layout. I would be tempted to focus on the more landscape gardens, places like Longleat in Wiltshire, where you get all the colour from the trees and all of those sort of things. Mm-hmm. So those were the ones I would focus on, because, of course, so many of the sort of perennial flowers and things are already past their best by then. But a lot of gardens are laid out. Sissinghurst, places like Sissinghurst are often laid out deliberately to give you some autumn colour as well.
And it is just a
lot. What was the name of that last one?
Sissinghurst in Kent. That was the garden laid out by Vita Sackville West.
Sissinghurst. I've found a lot of gardens are just lovingly landscaped wonderlands, with or without the flowers. They're just gorgeous to wander around a big manor house.
And bizarrely, even roses now seem to have a much longer flowering life in England.
Oh, that's interesting. It's a little confused now.
But there are other, Hidcot is a very excellent garden.
So let's talk about the gardens in general. Of course, Lynn's going in the fall, but just gardens in general, some of your favorite. Hidcot, H-I-D-C-O-T-E.
In Cotswolds.
In the Cotswolds. Yeah. And that is a gorgeous garden,
absolutely,
isn't it?
Stourhead, which is not very far from Stonehenge.
Stourhead.
Yes, absolutely phenomenal. Also landscaped.
Gillian, what's a favorite garden of yours?
Well, Sissinghurst definitely is one of my favorites.
What's the one up in northern Wales that's
Bodnant.
So nice?
Bodnant.
Bodnant Gardens. That's just delightful.
And that's a good example, because the roses were flowering there in October.
Mm. Yeah. And it's a huge ground. It's like going through a fantasy forest as well as a garden. I mean, there's a lot of dimensions to it.
And the view down the slopes to the river across to Snowdonia is absolutely phenomenal. So
yes,
you get the autumn colour, so and still Snowdonia.
That's called Bodnant Gardens.
Bodnant.
B-O-D-N-A-N-T. It's near, just south of Conway, I think.
Conway.
And Roy, where's your favourite, or where's a garden that we should know about?
Well, the one I like, which is not too far from Sissinghurst, is Great Dixter.
Great Dixter.
Yes, it's based around an old, the garden itself is 20th century, but it's based around an old medieval manor house, and it's got a beautiful garden on quite a small scale. Not even as large as Sissinghurst, but it's a beautiful garden.
And if you're concerned about the weather, you could be in London and go out to Kew Gardens.
Kew Gardens,
of course.
And there's an amazing greenhouse, right? It's a giant.
More than one.
Talk about Kew Gardens.
Kew Gardens houses, historically, some of the most important collections of plants from seas that were brought over.
So they're huge.
They're huge.
What do we call these big Victorian age glass houses?
Yeah.
It's like jungle. You
almost
can go to the jungle in London. You know, I went to Eden. What is it called?
The Eden Project.
I went to the Eden Project just last summer. That is pretty
wild. Fantastic.
These giant. There's like the desert and the tropics,
and
I think.
Jungle,
and they're giant geodesic domes and people that are just so passionate about the environment. So, Lynn, there's lots of opportunities for you to enjoy some beautiful gardens in England.
Right. Like I had heard of Kew, but the other ones are new to me.
All right, Lynn. Thanks for your call, Lynn.
Okay. Thank you so much for the information.
You bet. Happy travels.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're joined by Roy Nichols, Gillian Chadwick, and Tom Hooper, all guides from England. Our phone number is 877-333-7425. Karen's on the line in Santa Rosa, California. Karen, thank you so much for calling.
Hello. How are you?
Great. Do you have a favorite dimension of England you'd like to talk about with our guides?
I do. A couple years ago, we spent about 10 days in Scotland and decided we'd drive down to York instead of taking the train. And so we were looking for some things to do on the way and found out there's a stone circle about an hour south of Hadrian's Wall called Long Meg and Her Daughters. And apparently it's, the second largest stone circle after Stonehenge.
Wait a second, Long Meg and Her Daughters. That's yes. Such an English name. I love that. Long Meg and Her Daughters. So does that sort of mirror the design of the stones or something? Or there's some outlaying stones that are the daughters? Or how does that work?
Yeah, there's one tallest stone that, I don't know, is probably 10 to 15 feet tall. And the diameter of the circle is probably bigger than a football field. Maybe 350 feet in diameter. And there's somewhere between, 60, 70 stones in the circle. And it's in the middle of no place. So we had a wonderful drive on many one-lane country roads getting there. And fortunately, our GPS found it for us. But we were the only people there.
So you're all alone with your private Stonehenge.
Well, with Meg.
Exactly.
With Meg and her daughters.
She was with Meg and her daughters.
Roy, there must be a lot of Megs and their daughters.
Oh, there are. I mean, people tend to think of Avebury and Stonehenge, and they are rightly famous, but there are hundreds of different stone circles of varying sizes. And I know Long Megan and Daughters, not intimately, but it lies just to the east of Carlisle, and it is very typical of so many of these stone circles.
And there's some magic moments you can have all alone with your stone circle. Yeah, well, most of us travelers have our favorites. Yeah. What's your favorite, Tom, to be alone with a stone circle?
Probably Castlerigg.
Mm. Me too. Well, Castlerigg's great, and that's just 50 yards off of the road, so it's quite convenient.
Yes.
That's just before you get to Keswick.
But sometimes there's nobody there.
All alone at sunset with just a couple of New Age types that are sitting cross-legged there chanting or something. Gillian, do you have a favorite stone circle?
I was going to say Castlerigg as well.
Castlerigg is really a delight. If you're going into Cumbrian Lake District in the north, you got to stop at Castlerigg. Mm. Part of that is because it's on a little bluff surrounded by like a stone circle of mountains, it seems like, and it's all calibrated together. I was just down in Dartmoor, and there's so many beautiful megaliths and so on, and the Gidley Circle.
Yeah, the Gidley Circle down.
Man, that is so nice. But if you have a map, how would you find all these circles, right?
Well, I mean, they are on the Ordnance Survey maps, but a good thing to do, there is online resources that you can go and find out lists. There's actually a society that sort of lists all of these.
How old are these things?
Well, they're generally sort of either late Neolithic or generally Bronze Age. So we're looking about sort of 2,500 BC through to about 1,500 BC.
So old as the pyramids.
Well, in England.
Castlerigg's older. 3,000 BC.
So it's really a matter of, as Karen was talking about, getting out the GPS, doing your study, and going down those little lanes and finding your own stone circle.
And there are huge numbers of them right across the country from one end to the other.
Karen, any other thoughts on stone circles, Karen?
It was funny because there was a little road that just went through the middle of the stone circle to a farmhouse down the road. So as my husband and I were walking around the stone circles trying to count them to see if we came up with the same number, which we did not, little car goes by to the farmhouse.
When I see those little farmhouses and stone, I think about 600 years ago, that stone circle was there, the farm was there, and there was probably some very superstitious ideas about what the stone circle meant, and you would never walk there, and you would stay away, and you might pour some beer on it at Christmas or whatever.
A bit pagan.
Pagan. Karen, thanks for your call.
Oh, no problem. It was great. Thank you.
You bet. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We've been talking about traveling in England with our three wonderful English guides, Tom Hooper, Gillian Chadwick, and Roy Nichols. Roy, Gillian, Tom, thanks a lot.
It's been
a
pleasure.
You're welcome.
Welcome.
After moving to Seattle, Scots-born Chris Ray realized he sometimes had to choose his words carefully to be understood by us Yanks. There's plenty of slang, and even common English words can confuse people on either side of the Atlantic since they don't always refer to the same things. So Chris compiled a sort of mini dictionary and website listing many commonly used terms in the UK that might baffle an American or Canadian whilst in Britain. Chris joins us from the Travel with Rick Steves archives. A lot of people are kind of stressed out about the language barrier, so they go to Britain. And when they get to Britain, they realize there's a language barrier. In fact, Oscar Wilde said, America and Britain are two nations divided by a common language. I'm joined today by Chris Ray, who's written a book about the language barrier Americans will experience when they go to Britain. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Your book is called The Septic's Companion. An American has to ask right off the bat, what do you mean by septic? I think of septic tank.
Yep, and you would be right thinking of that. To explain the title, I guess I have to explain a little bit about Cockney rhyming slang.
Okay, so these are the people that live sort of working class down the river in London, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
I think technically it's people who were born within the sound of Bow Bells Church or that kind of thing. So Cockney rhyming slang is a wordplay where you use a two-word couplet to refer to another word which rhymes with the second word of the couplet. So to give you an example of ones that are in sort of everyday use in the UK, butcher's hook is used to mean the word look. And you can then say...
Just so, because hook rhymes with look.
Exactly.
It's that simple.
Precisely. Right.
Okay, so give me another example.
So let's say loaf. People use loaf of bread to say head. And I ought to add that you don't necessarily have to use both words of this couplet to mean the other word. So you could say loaf to mean head, and you could say butchers to mean look. Use your loaf is a very common phrase in the UK.
So butcher's hook means look.
Correct.
Give it a butcher's hook, give it a look.
Give it a butcher's, yeah.
And you could then just say, give it a butcher's.
Mm-hmm.
This is like a secret language of the Cockney people. Is that so poor people can communicate without rich people understanding?
It's an interesting one. Cockney rhyming slang is curious because if you ask a Brit for examples of Cockney rhyming slang, they'll give you reams and reams of them. And in actual fact, a lot of them are not in real life usage. A lot of them are just ones that maybe were used a long time ago or that people bring out as examples of Cockney rhyming slang, but they're not in everyday use.
You're Scottish.
I'm Scottish, yeah.
So you grew up in where? Edinburgh or something?
I grew up in Edinburgh. I lived in London for 10 years.
So if you went down into within the earshot of Bow's Bells or whatever, you would hear people in the working class neighborhoods still talking a lot of Cockney stuff?
Oh, yes. I mean, all over the UK, people will use, like the examples I gave you, butcher's loaf, people say Jackie's to mean Jackie Onassis, glasses. You know, let me
so
put my Jackie's
Jackie
on.
So Jackie Onassis rhymes with glasses. So you could say Jackie Onassis to mean glasses, and then you could just drop the thing that rhymes and just call it Jackie's, which means glasses.
Yep.
That's very complicated. Okay, getting back to our original question then, why is your book called The Septic's Companion?
You were right to start with. Septic tank is rhyming slang for yank, which to a Brit is anyone in America.
Septic tank. So you could call a yank a septic tank if you're Cockney, and then if you're really casual with the language, just shorten it by calling it a septic. So Cockney people can call a Yankee a septic.
Correct.
There you go. So this is the septic's companion.
Yeah.
Got it. Okay. I'm just going to ask you a few of these and we'll talk about it. Baltic. Baltic.
Baltic, yes. Very cold.
So is that just because the Baltics are up in the north?
Yeah, I think it really is that simple.
So it's like Baltic out.
Yep.
It's like we could say it's Alaskan out.
Yes.
But we don't. Bangers. I see that on the menus. You want some bangers?
Yep.
What is
and,
that?
And usually in bangers and mash. Bangers are just sausages. The etymology is a little vague, but it likely comes from the fact that, that sausages bang if they're sausages with thick skins and you fry them for a little too long.
Or they pop when they're cooking.
Yeah.
Bangers. Oh, okay. Well, you have crackers at Christmas, right? Little toys that pop?
We do.
On a bank holiday, you might have bangers. What's a bank holiday?
So to a Brit, a holiday is not only a sort of preset holiday by the state, it's also just any time off work. And a bank holiday is traditionally a day when the banks are shut. And so this is a state holiday when the banks are shut.
So in our country, President's Day, Veterans Day, a day when the banks are shut,
yep.
You would just call a holiday a bank holiday.
Yeah, that's true.
School would be out, banks are closed. It's a holiday, bank holiday.
Yeah, and actually bank holidays have become a little bit more, they're harder to nail down these days. Many people working in the UK will get bank holidays off. Many people will not get bank holidays off and they'll get a day in lieu instead.
But nobody's beavering on a bank holiday.
Beavering meaning kind of working away busily, of course.
Is that what beavering means?
Yeah, it does indeed, yeah. And I think, again, it's just much like, you know, beaver is kind of chewing away.
So beavers are like busy as a busy, what do we say, a busy bunny or busy...
Yeah, busy, we could say beaver.
Busy as a beaver.
Yeah.
Okay, so beavering is working hard.
Yep, it is indeed.
Our guest on Travel with Rick Steves is Chris Ray. He's the author of The Septic's Companion, which he calls a mercifully brief guide to British culture and language. By the way, the title owes a bit to Cockney rhyming slang, which he explains further in the book. His website is septicscompanion.com, and that's without an apostrophe. Chris, I'd like to just go on a couple of words here just for fun here. Afters. When you're looking on the menu, it says afters. What are we looking at there?
Yeah, you're looking at desserts. It's an interesting one that we don't call appetizers befores, but we do call them starters. And you see that a little bit on US menus, so that's reasonably well known. But
so there's some confusion in entrees. That's our big course.
Yeah, that's true. We would call that a main course.
And what is an entree for you?
An entree is a starter for
us. It's an appetizer.
Yes. There is a little bit of confusion on that one, I'm willing to admit.
That is confusing. Okay. Now, sometimes somebody, it's bad weather out and they want to put on their anorak. Am I pronouncing that right? Anorak.
You're pronouncing that exactly right.
Okay. So that's what we would call a parka.
Yeah, exactly. It's supposedly, the word anorak also means someone who's a bit kind of nerdy about a particular topic. There's a bit of a debate about the etymology of it, but historically in the UK, we had very tightly controlled radio, and some of the radio stations broadcast from ships offshore to avoid the rules. And the fans of those radio stations would go out and stand on the ships and, to take part in the radio programs, all wearing anoraks. And it's possible that the word anorak, as meaning sort of a nerdy person, came from the description of those fans by the radio program people.
So an anorak is a geek.
Yeah, exactly.
Because he wears a waterproof jacket to be on a radio show.
Yeah.
Obviously. And anti-clockwise. Of course, we have counterclockwise.
Yeah, I don't know how we ended up doing that differently.
Anti-clockwise.
But so yes.
If you say counterclockwise in Britain, it's not right.
It's the case with a lot of words. If you're American, Brits get a lot of exposure to American television and this kind of stuff. But also with this particular one, it's reasonably easy to guess at. But certainly you'll get a double take if you use that.
So if you're going into a roundabout, you don't go anti-clockwise. Because the British drive on the left side of the road, you're going to go into this, you're not going to stop at a stop sign, and you're going to go clockwise.
Correct.
And if you have an articulated lorry, what does that mean?
A lorry is what Americans would call a big truck. And an articulated lorry is one that's kind of bent in the middle, so that the cab part will separate from the container part.
How about blimey? Where does that come from? Blimey. You hear that on movies a lot.
Yeah, that's true. Or the sort of longer phrase, core blimey, is like an older version of the same thing. I think it's reasonably certain that the etymology of that is from the phrase, God blind me. And that comes from some sort of version of, may God blind me if this is not so.
Okay, I could see that in medieval times and then just kind of evolving into blimey.
Yeah, but blimey now is very much an everyday phrase in the UK.
Now, I like to say bloody, bloody hot. But when I say that, other people act like I'm cursing or swearing. Is it really a bad word, bloody?
In that context, it's maybe...
It's like damned, isn't it?
It's very like damn in that sense. You'd never put it up in, a presentation you were doing, but, you wouldn't get fired for using it ever, I don't think.
So it's just a strong word.
It's a sort of mild swear word.
Where did that word come from, bloody?
I think it's from By Our Lady. This is another
so another God blind me sort of thing. So a lot of the Christian sort of medieval heritage of England survives in its bloody language.
Yep, true.
All right. Bob's your uncle. I love that when people say Bob's your uncle.
Yeah, I hope you're not going to ask me where that comes from because I have no idea.
I just hardly, it makes sense when somebody says it, but I have a hard time explaining it. How do you define, Bob's your uncle?
It's kind of like, you're done, that's it.
It's kind of like, well, obviously, right?
Yeah, kind of. It's like, that's it complete. Once you complete these steps, Bob's your uncle.
I see.
You're done.
So you follow the directions carefully, 1, 2, 3, and Bob's your uncle.
Exactly, yeah. Turn left at the bank, down the road and, Bob's
and
your uncle.
It's not rocket science. Bob's your uncle.
Yep.
Chris, we've just scratched the surface, but it's a fascinating thing, studying the language barrier between Britain and America. Chris has written The Septic's Companion. Chris's website is septicscompanion.com. Chris, in Britain, you would say cheers. Does that mean sort of thanks?
Yep, cheers means pretty much thanks. We might also say a little bit more informally, ta or ta very much.
Ta. And ta, where what would that be from?
I believe it's from the Scandinavian word tak, meaning thank you.
All the Scandinavians say tak, so in England you just drop the K, ta. Ta very much.
Thank you.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington by Tim Tatton, Kazmira Hall, and Donna Bardsley. Affiliate relations are by Sheila Gerzoff. Website uploads are managed by Andrew Wakeling. Jerry Frank wrote and performed our theme music. You can find links to our guests and search the show archives at ricksteves.com/radio. We'll see you next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.